Hello, and welcome to the Agile Embedded Podcast. I'm Jeff Gable.
And I'm Luca Ingerni.
And today we're going to talk about technical debt in embedded systems development. Luca, you suggested this topic, and I was all for it.
Yeah, this is an interesting one, because my observation during trainings has been that many people are not familiar with the term, but everybody knows the phenomenon as such. So how about we start with just explaining what is technical debt? Jeff, can you tell us?
Sure. So I would define it as technical decisions that are good in the short term and bad in the long term, especially for development speed. Mm-hmm. And I remember you had a kind of a more precise or maybe more concise way of expressing that, trading present velocity for future velocity. And I like that.
Yeah, but it still sounds kind of abstract. Like, can you think of an example for that?
Oh, certainly. So let's talk about maybe what this actually looks like in real life. So anytime you essentially let poor technical decisions linger, you throw together some architecture, you write out a function and you have bad variable names. It works. It solves your immediate problem, but long term, it's going to be harder to maintain or harder to extend. Anytime you let documentation get out of sync with code, or don't document code at all, or write code that's maybe confusing and you don't explain, you know, what's going on. These are things that make it, like I just said, harder to maintain down the road, and that's going to cost you velocity in the future. But it may make it more faster to get whatever you're trying to do done right now. So you just want to get this function done and show this functionality and ship it and you're done. Mm-hmm. And it is faster if you don't take the time to document or refactor or think about your architecture. All of these things are true. It is faster to get it out the door immediately.
It is faster now.
It is faster now and it will be slower later.
Exactly. So that's the thing. And I would like to point out as well that technical debt is not something, or not necessarily, you can do it consciously, but very often it's something that sneaks up on you. Like, I'm sure you didn't set out to create a bad architecture. Of course, you set up the best architecture you knew how to create, but maybe back when you built it, you weren't as knowledgeable as you are now. Or maybe just the demands on the architecture have changed. Like, maybe you set up a database that was to take care of 10 devices, but now it's taking care of 10,000. You know, it was a wonderful architecture for 10 devices, but now, it's straining under the load.
And I can say, so you just said something interesting, which is that people often don't take on technical debt intentionally. And that is true. I will say, once you've been around this topic and have heard of this before, you may very intentionally take on technical debt because the short-term business goals are worth it. You need, like in an agile context, say you're prototyping, and you want to essentially get something done enough to get feedback on it as to whether you're even building the right thing. In that case, it may be entirely appropriate to take on technical debt to get a prototype out there that has bad architecture behind the scenes, but you need the result of that running in front of users to actually get feedback. In the web startup world, they say essentially don't worry about technical debt when you're still trying to find product market fit, when you don't even know who your customers are and whether they will pay your money. And you're still trying to very rapidly iterate and determine exactly what you're going to build, then don't worry about your architecture as much. Obviously there's always a balancing act. There's always a trade-off, but definitely bias towards getting something out there. And I think the same thing can exist in the embedded systems world. I would say during the prototyping phase, technical debt is good. That's exactly what a prototype is. You don't care how it's built behind the scenes. But once it's time to actually bring a product to market and release it, especially in a safety critical context, then you've got to pay down that technical debt and clean up your architecture.
Yes. And like this is, you mentioned in passing one of the famous sources of horrendous technical debt, which is that you build something as a prototype and then once it's running, you take it and slap it into production. Like, oh yeah, works good enough.
Yep.
Yeah, you can do it, but you will pay for it, I think.
Right. It's funny. A potential client right now is talking to me about exactly this kind of project where they rushed a prototype to market, and you know, they tested it and it's safe, but it's got pretty horrendous architecture on the back end and is not maintainable. And essentially they want me to come in and refactor it and clean it up and essentially pay down all of that technical debt.
And yeah, maybe that was the right thing to do. Like, either they get it out the door now and they get funding to continue development, or the thing just dies. So fine, take on the technical debt, secure funding, and then of course use some of it to pay down this debt that you accrued for good reason.
Right. So is the issue really is it really a problem when people just don't realize that they're accumulating technical debt? They think there's a mismatch in expectations. They think their product is in good shape when it actually isn't. Is that really the source of the issue?
Okay. So there's a couple of layers to this, I think. So the first layer is that, yes, you can take on, and in fact, you will take on technical debt without meaning to or without realizing it. Like, this is just, so, you know, software will grow moldy over time. And you need to make an effort to clean it back up. That's, you know, that's just one expression of technical debt, maybe. The other aspect is that technical debt is not visible. Like, that's the insidious thing about it. It's not a bug. The system is working, just like you described with your customer. The system is working. It's doing its job. Everything is fine on the surface. But if you lift the covers, you know, it doesn't look so nice. And those of us with experience and technical expertise can tell, oh, this is going to become a problem. But non-technical people, end users, management perhaps, they can't tell. This is invisible to them. And that's something that's very insidious about technical debt as compared to bugs. Like, I can point at something that doesn't work and say, see, it's not working.
Right. And the symptoms are often, you know, we preach so much, you know, because we're talking about agile principles on getting fast feedback. When you have large levels of technical debt, and kind of the, you know, the reason this phrase was coined is it has the analogy to financial debt in that you're paying interest. That interest is essentially like what you're paying is a decrease in your velocity and your development speed. And so the symptom of this is that over time, your development team just gets slower and slower and slower at releasing new features or fixing bugs. And you know, essentially poor architecture behind the scenes or kind of even more specific, say, poor coding practices, like as simple as bad variable names. I wouldn't call that an architecture problem.
But you know, it adds up to
technical debt. Absolutely.
Yeah, like I was working on a system, and the system for some reason had a door. And there was a variable that was called door state. It was a Boolean variable, and it had the states true and false, of course, as Boolean variables do. To this day, I have no idea whether door state true meant whether that the door was open or closed. Like, how do you maintain such a system? And it can be as trivial as that, but it's sort of like if you do this over and over again, the developer who wrote that had this unfortunate tendency of not thinking very hard about the variable names. And it just makes it unmaintainable. That's technical debt, even though it was just some ordinary, boring Boolean variable that wasn't doing anything fancy. This is not about architectural algorithms. Just about a name.
Right, right. So what are some more specific things that you know, technical debt applies to, I guess, any highly technical endeavor? You know, it's a mm-hmm. it's a well-known phrase in the software world, but what are some specific expressions of this for embedded systems for our listeners? You know, obviously the things that you know separates embedded systems from other software efforts is that it's closely tied to the hardware. So one thing I can think of is a version of poor architecture is poor abstraction of the hardware. For instance, like your code is very, very tied to the processor using, the specific chips you're using on the board. You know, it's you don't essentially make those architectural interface layers to where, you know, okay, one day you say, oh, this chip, like maybe we don't change processors, microcontrollers, but this chip that we're using doesn't work and we want to add a new one in and it's got a different, you know, SPI interface. Mm-hmm. If that change isn't isolated to a very, very low level specific part of your code, then you've done something wrong. And it's now like making that change is going to be much harder, much slower than it should be. That's one example of, you know, the specific kind of technical debt that we have to deal with in embedded systems. Can you think of any others, Luca?
Yeah, I think a lot of technical debt also just comes from miscommunication or communication that just didn't happen. Like, you know, your electronics engineers, your electrical engineers, they designed some kind of a circuit and it has maybe funny behavior in certain, you know, maybe there's a resonance somewhere or, you know, anything like that. That is, I guess, akin to unfortunate architecture, and you need to handle that. You need to deal with that. And maybe you do that in electronically, I don't know, with a filter or something, or you do it in software by filtering out this resonance or making sure you're not actually approaching this frequency range or whatever it is. But, you know, it slows you down. It's something you need to deal with. And then maybe somebody swaps out a capacitor for another value. And then all of a sudden this resonance range moves somewhere else and you need to chase it in software. And, you know, that's a funny thing about technical debt. You can also export it to other functions or other teams. And that's, of course, true in the general case, but maybe it's particularly easy and particularly insidious in embedded systems where, like, the electronics people, maybe they weren't even really aware of the problem they were causing, and they didn't mean to create this technical debt and push it onto the software people, but this is what maybe ended up happening.
So explore that a little bit more for me. So, because when you first told me about exporting technical debt, I didn't quite understand what you meant. So essentially, is that saying like one team has created technical debt and then another team is responsible for solving it or essentially has to deal with it?
Exactly. So either it's technical debt that would be sort of local to your team, like this resonance, but you are deliberately or accidentally not dealing with it, and somebody downstream has to, or you can even sort of knowingly say, fine, you know, this circuit has this problem, and we're making it somebody else's problem.
I see. And that is particularly insidious for organizations that are poorly structured and don't, you know, take the holistic systems level view of things where we're all on the same team. We're all in the same company. Mm-hmm. We're mm-hmm. all trying to get this product out the door. In companies that are more siloed, you know, you may say the hardware team essentially may make decisions that are expeditious for them in the short term and will cause mm-hmm. problems for the software team down the road. This is a classic hardware engineer, software engineer, you know, battle that is fought. And teams that are better organized and better managed to break down those silos and view things from a little more holistic, everyone is responsible for getting the product out the door. Those teams are in a better position to solve those kinds of issues because there's not this, I don't know, this very rigid, like my job is done, now it's your job. And that kind of interaction is just so painful. And so costly to your development speed and how fast you can get quality products out the door.
In DevOps, there's this famous metaphor of the wall of confusion, which typically, like on one side of the wall, you've got your developers, and on the other side of the wall, you've got your operations. The developers famously just throw the product over the wall at the operations people, and they get to get it to run somehow and keep it in production somehow. And, you know, this metaphor holds for many other industries and for many other constellations. And I could easily imagine there being walls of confusion between like the mechanical and the electrical and the software engineers.
Absolutely. Yep. I've seen it over and over.
Exactly. And of course, what happens is that in any case, those who suffer, apart from all the engineers, are the customers. Like, they don't get as good a product as they could. They get it, you know, later, whatever, because technical debt was not dealt with. And just to, I mean, we've been talking about this, like, it's somebody's conscious choice to push a problem on somebody else. Sometimes that happens, but, you know, most people are fundamentally, you know, cooperative and nice and don't really want to do that sort of thing. But sometimes it happens accidentally and it needs to get dealt with. Speaking of, how do we do that? How do you deal with technical debt?
So the first thing is you can do nothing. How's that going to work out for you?
Well, as we discussed before, it may be the right approach. Like, if you're a startup and you're about to run out of funding, don't worry about technical debt. Don't worry about the future if you've got enough trouble in the present. So that may be a viable strategy, but of course, in many cases, it isn't. So what could be another approach? What do you think, Jeff?
Right. So there's a... I think you would call it the Boy Scout rule, and I think I've known it by a different term, which is essentially always leave things cleaner than when you found them, the way you found them. So say, you know, this often happens if you have this big legacy code base. Maybe your team has been developing this product for a year, 2 years, longer, and you're realizing now you've seen the cruft and how it's affecting your team, and the velocity of the team is really, really low. And you say, okay, we're going to pay down some technical debt. You can whole hog it, where you dive in and actually, you know, take a few development sprints and do nothing but pay down technical debt and refactor and re-architect. But that, you know, that means your delivery of new features drops to zero, which is often unacceptable. So one way to handle this is that A, any new code you write, you'd be much more careful to make sure that it doesn't contain technical debt, that it's well-written, that it's well-reviewed, well-architected. And then as you're inevitably touching parts of the legacy code base, you clean up the parts that you touch. And it's very tempting at that point just to go nuts and start refactoring everything. And that's where it's basically you have to use your engineering judgment and say, is it worth the trade-off to continue this thread, or do I just clean up what I touch and I made it better, and then the next time I touch a different part of the legacy code base, I'll clean that up. That's one strategy for maintaining some present velocity and cleaning things up slowly in a gradual fashion rather than all at once.
Hmm. Hmm. Exactly. So that's certainly one thing you can do. Be, you know, as you touch your code base, you make sure that it's a little better than it was before you touched it. But nonetheless, I think it's important to actually track work on technical debt as you would any other work. So technical debt should not just be something that's, you know, that you're doing secretly as you're working on features to keep management happy or something, but it's also, you know, it is something that you explicitly track as work in user stories or however you manage your work, and you will have technical debt stories that say, oh, clean up this interface, I don't know, straighten out this architecture, and that goes in the project backlog if you have such a thing, and it gets pulled into your workflow, into your sprint or whatever, and it gets done.
Yeah, that definitely falls under the principle of making work visible. And you had actually pointed out a book to me that I haven't read by a woman named Domenica De Grandis. But that principle I have heard before of essentially making work visible. It's invisible work that slows you down and you don't know why, kind of by definition. And when you know, as an organization, if you're looking at your development team and you're trying to release features and everything's just going more slowly than it should, it's because your team is spending time on things that you're not tracking. and you have to surface those and make them explicit. And if it's due to bad architecture, then that's something, I mean, like your team will tell you, they know, or you as the technical expert, you know, and you essentially have to maybe sell that to management. Like, this is slowing us down. I've got to explicitly spend some time on this and, you know, pitch it as something that's worth it and will increase your future velocity and enable you to provide value. But you've got to make it visible. You can't just let it linger.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. Like, how do you find technical debt? You know, it's actually easy. You know exactly where it is.
You know where it is. Just exactly. Just follow your gut.
Exactly. Exactly. The things that annoy you, that's technical debt. That is something that, you know, that you're not just entitled, but essentially obliged to manage responsibly and take care of.
Any other things that are kind of specific to the embedded systems world? One thing I can think of is a problem I see, especially in the early stages. You're not necessarily prototyping, but you're still hardware bugs are still being discovered and ironed out. And one of the things I see specifically in the embedded systems world is this proliferation of different hardware configurations among either out in the field or among different members of the team. And then essentially your software team has to support all of these different hardware revisions, some of which have bugs that require software hacks. And then you have more recent hardware revisions where those bugs are fixed. And to me, that's a very, very tempting state to get into, especially if you're management. And every one of those hardware prototypes was really expensive. It was really expensive. Mm-hmm. Like you may have spent thousands and thousands of dollars on these prototypes, and your software team saying, "Oh, I have to support them. Can't you get rid of them?" And you say, "No, like those were expensive. Like, keep supporting them." That's a very like I have learned over time that the as many thousands of dollars as you spent on that hardware, like that's one day, maybe 2 days of the cost of a good software engineer. And you, I always push where I'm responsible for it, I decide, and where I'm not responsible for it, I push really hard to ruthlessly minimize the number of hardware configurations that are out there. And if there are boards that are previous rev and can be upconverted, can be, you know, you cut traces and solder on wires or whatever to bring that up to the latest revision to where it operates just like a new revision, great. If not, get rid of it. That's one thing specific to embedded systems, a form of technical debt that is extremely common, and people don't really realize how bad it is. And I would really, really encourage you to try to ruthlessly eliminate that kind of thing.
Actually, there's one group of people who know exactly how terrible it is, and that's the technical support guys. Because I remember.
I have a problem. What version are you using? Yeah.
Exactly. How can I tell? Like, oh, is this version 3.5a or the version 3.5b or 3.5a with two capacitors soldered on because we didn't really know what was going on? I used to work at a company that had this problem. They had thousands of machines in the field and they had no idea what was in any of those machines. And so it was always an adventure for the service techs to go out in the field to a customer site and you know, and debug a machine or repair a machine that was broken down somehow, that was essentially a robot. And they'd always have this case of spares because they had no idea what was in there very specifically and how it interacted also with like bespoke modifications to the software. And that was just, yeah, that's a very valid example of technical debt. And I'm, yeah, that was an excellent example, Jeff.
And even that, like I would separate it between, you know, this problem during development and then once it goes in the field. Once you have products in the field, you don't have a choice. I mean, there's no getting rid of them. They're in customers' hands. I would say the things you can do ahead of time to mitigate that is make the software, make it obvious in some fashion what version of hardware it is. Either it's it's something that, like, you know, a set of resistor banks or whatever, that where essentially the software knows what version of hardware it's running on and can then, you know, if it's in the field, and especially if it's an IoT device where it's reporting data back to you, that you can tell remotely what version of hardware you're dealing with. And that's a hardware architecture decision that you make early that will pay dividends once things go to the field. When I first brought that issue up of this configuration management, I was more talking about just in the process of development. Again, I work in medical devices, and you know, it's a multi-year program from start to finish before we release devices. So we have plenty of time, even within the development team, for these different versions of hardware to proliferate. And that's something where, you know, they're not in customer hands. You have the power. Stop supporting the early prototypes and really ruthlessly limit the number of versions you're supporting. But yeah, once they're in customers' hands, I feel for you. That is a harder situation.
Yeah. So this is another tempting topic that I really want to get into with you at some point. Version control of not just software, but also hardware, and even worse, like combined actual systems, and how to deal with that whole mess. So, but let's not go there. Let's stay with technical debt for now, because it's, you know, it's juicy enough as it is. There's one thing that I think you will very much like me to talk about. You know, one of the things that I really insist on when I deal with technical debt is to have good automated tests in place.
Yes.
Like that, that is so crucial, I think, to daring to fiddle, you know, with things like architecture and making sure you're not making it worse somehow. You really need to be, you know, well protected, have this safety net of decent tests, both unit tests and like actual system tests that also watch things like response times and all of the other non-functional requirements that you might end up influencing with your changes. If you feel uneasy about dealing with a technical debt, I suspect you need better test coverage.
I could not possibly agree more. I love this. And that's actually the reason I practice test-driven development in my code, is because when I have a comprehensive passing set of unit tests that is run automatically, it's just so freeing. At that point, you can refactor at will, and you know exactly when you've broken it. You know, there are limits to this, but the better your test coverage, the better they need to be well-designed tests where they're not testing implementation details. They're truly testing interfaces. If you test all aspects of the interface, you can refactor the implementation behind that interface to your heart's content and make it gorgeous and maintainable. And it's so fast to do so. The reason you didn't do it is because it's like refactoring is painful, but if you have good passing tests, then you can refactor quickly because you're confident that you haven't broken anything. Great point. Great point.
Would it be fair to say that a lack of adequate testing is actually technical debt in itself?
Sure. Sure. I don't think we really need to draw a line between the two. Essentially, it was a technical decision that someone made that was expeditious in the short term. Writing tests take time. It's faster to write code without tests. In the very early stages, just write the function, like do a few manual tests. It works great. Move on. And it slows you down in the long run. So yes, absolutely. So we've talked about technical debt. You know, I don't want to get too off topic here, but you could easily extend this debt metaphor to kind of other aspects of an organization. You know, we've talked at certain points about process debt, about culture debt. Do you want to maybe touch on those, Luca?
Yes. So that's the thing. So this metaphor, as you just said, is it extends very well to other aspects of your work. And in fact, sometimes it's maybe a bit hard and not particularly relevant, I suppose, to differentiate between, I don't know, process debt and technical debt. But one example that you brought up in the on the in the discussion before the show was, maybe you are experiencing the process debt of having manual test and release cycles. That's a process debt that is something that's slowing you down. Of course, you didn't invest the effort of building, say, a CI system, but now you're paying the price in terms of, you know, slow cycles and awkward releases and maybe increased error rates, you know, you miss a step in your release process, whatever. And so, of course, you could pay back that technical debt, or rather that process debt, through technical means. For example, set up a CI server. And the same thing goes for culture, for instance. You can say that, I mean, even trivial stuff like whether people are on time for meetings, you can say this is something that slows you down. That is something that you need to tackle and that will take effort to remedy in some way. Maybe just emotional energy by like pointing out, look, you've been too late again. And have those awkward discussions that nobody really likes. Or at least I don't.
Yeah, and I like, you know, maybe some things aren't as useful to classify as debt because they didn't even help you in the short term. They were just, you know, bad practice or bad decisions. You can think of cultural or organizational debt. You can even think of it from a management perspective as, you know, you have the wrong employee in a key position, but you don't want to get rid of them because that will slow you down in the short term, but it's costing you in the long term. I think that's a really clear example of organizational debt where you as a manager or a leader in your company, someone underneath you is just the wrong person for the job or needs to be moved around or some, maybe you have another person who's clearly right and you'd love to promote that other person, but it would hurt this, like it would cause short-term friction. Those are the kind of things there's always a trade-off there, but I would certainly strongly say that's the kind of debt you don't tolerate. You got to have the right team in the right place, but that's getting a little off topic. That's well off the line of technical debt, but it at least illustrates that this debt metaphor can apply to all across your organization.
Yes. And that you, I think, should keep your eyes peeled because it, you know, it exists in many different forms, but once you become sensitive to it, you will spot that, you know, things are going on that could be better. So why not make them better? And, you know, pay the short-term cost and reap the benefits forever after.
Sounds good. Well, what do you think? I think we've tackled this topic pretty thoroughly.
I'd agree. Yeah. No, that was a great episode.
Sounds good. All right. We're going to wrap it up. Luca, where can people go to find you online?
I can be found at luca.engineer. What about you, Jeff? Where can people find you?
You can find me at jeffgable.com. And I write and speak regularly, you can find a contact form in my contact information there. And please reach out. I love to talk about agile topics and embedded systems, and can help you with whatever issue you're having. So please reach out.
Wonderful.
This has been the Agile Embedded Podcast. I'm Jeff Gable,
and I'm Luca Ingiani,
and we will see you next time. Thank you.
See you. Bye.